Did you see, just before we, actually, I will press the button now. Did you see my rant about how my recorder allows me to be stupid?
Welcome to another episode of Discover ADN, a podcast featuring conversations with people from all over the world. In this second season of the show, we'll talk to some wonderful people and hear their stories on what inspires them, what decisions have changed their careers, and what relationships have influenced their work. Today, I have the privilege of talking once again to Jeremy Cherfis, a man who calls Italy his home and has recently decided to kick the day job to the curb to be his own boss again. He's well known for his informative and James Beard Foundation Award-nominated show, Eat This Podcast, and he's also the first person to make an appearance on this show three times, and that's gotta count for something, right? So, welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Well, thank you, Jason. Thank you. I'm deeply flattered to have been invited to the show three times. That makes this the show that I have contributed most to.
Well, I do appreciate it. If nobody else does, I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, you have recently transitioned to be your own boss, but I'd like to start by asking you about your previous job. So can you tell us a little bit about what you used to do until a few months ago?
Yeah, I worked for a small communications business that was, the headquarters was in England, but it was a completely virtual company. So there was staff in Italy, me, and another person. There was staff in Canada, in South Africa, in Europe, and mostly in England and Wales. And everybody worked from home. The company was based in the UK, and it was specialized in doing writing, editing, design, printing, production, mostly for nonprofits, research organizations involved in what we called natural resource management, which was sort of agriculture, water, that sort of thing. And I was the head of strategic communications for that company. And then, that was basically it. So working with many, many different clients, doing lots of different things from writing a 600-word press release to working with the company to develop their overall communication strategy, training, all sorts of things to do with communications.
All from the comfort of your home.
Mostly from the comfort of my home or from client locations occasionally for some clients. Don't forget, it's a lot easier to send one person to a meeting than it is to send all those people to see one person. So a fair bit of travel, not a huge amount, but a fair bit of travel going to clients and going to meetings. All from the comfort of my own home. Which is great. I like that. I like that a lot. It gives me a chance to do the other things I have to do or want to do without getting in the way of work.
Is that also one of the reasons that attracted you to the working for this virtual company?
Yes, it was. Very much so. Yeah. I mean, I got to stay in Rome. I decided to leave my old job, which was based in Rome with a big research organization here in Rome. I had decided to leave them, and I was looking around for ways to do that. And this opportunity arose, which would allow me to stay in Rome. And just about everything else I saw wanted me to move to wherever they were. So, yes, that was a factor.
And how long did you do that?
About 2 years, yep.
A slightly odd question, perhaps, but how often do you change jobs?
Well, that's very interesting, because I don't know what I regard as my job. This is part of my problem. Let me think. I was in my previous job for 15 years. So I came here in 2000 and I left. I was in my previous job for 13 years. I came to Rome in 2000 and I quit that job in early 2013. Before that, I hadn't had a salary for 20 years. something like that. There's this sort of slightly highfalutin term called a portfolio worker. I had lots of jobs, some of which paid me regularly, others of which were more in the way of individual freelancing. And then the job I had before that was as a university lecturer in 1984, 1983, something like that. So between 1983 and 2000, I was basically freelancing, doing a whole lot of different things. So I don't know how you want to count that, but I get. I was listening to Randolph on your show. I don't get bored quite as frequently as he does, but I get bored fairly frequently. And some jobs allow you to not get bored at all, even though you've been doing them forever. And other jobs get very boring very quickly. And so one of the good parts about being a freelance or a consultant is, yeah, you do get to change what you're doing fairly frequently.
When was it that you were in that documentary? I can't remember if it was a BBC or National Geographic, but I remember seeing you in a video driving a Jeep. What was that when you were stationed in or working at your previous job in Rome, or was that before that?
Oh, that was long before that, Jason. That was when I was young and foolish. That was 1982-3, and you saw me driving not a Jeep but a Land Rover. Let's get our nationalities in perspective here. I was driving a Land Rover in one of the safari parks in England, and that was part of a TV series called Zoo 2000, which I made with the BBC in 1982. I think it came out in 82 or 80. I can't even remember when it came out. And alas, I no longer have copies of any of it. My VHS tape's all jammed up, and I don't have any copy, and I don't know whether they do. But yeah, that was. I worked in TV. I worked in radio, and those are all I would call those freelance. You don't get most of the voices you hear and people you see in that kind of documentary, they're not on a salary. They may be on a retainer, but they're just getting paid on a per program basis, and so it can be a bit precarious.
How about the book that you wrote? The I'm pulling a blank.
Well, which one? I'd help you out if there were just one or two, but there are actually quite a lot. Do you mean The Redundant Mail?
That's it, The Redundant Mail. I was thinking Obsolete, but I knew it wasn't Obsolete.
No.
So with these books, did you write those for yourself, or did you write that with the help of a publisher who came to you and said, look, we want you to do this kind of thing? How did those books, or that particular book, come to life?
Okay, again, you're going way back into my history. that book was one of a pair of books that I wrote with John Gribbin, who is much more famous as an author than I am. He's the guy who wrote Schrodinger's Cat, among other things, but that's his main claim to fame. And that came out of the job. We went far back. I said I was working at a university, teaching at a university, and I was. But before that, I was actually biology editor of New Scientist magazine. And John Gribbin came to me one day and said, had I read a particular paper about human evolution? And I said, yeah, I've read it, but it's rubbish. And he said, well, why is it rubbish? And John and I were good friends. And so I said, oh, all right, give me a day or two. And I read it, and I read the criticisms, and I decided it wasn't rubbish. This was the paper, very first paper, talking about what's known as the molecular clock. which is using the differences between molecules in different species to tell you something about how long ago the two species diverged. I mean, basically, while a species is one breeding population, then the DNA gets shuffled up among the members of that population, and so the individuals are more or less like one another. But once two species have stopped interbreeding and become two different species, then their DNA goes on its separate pathways and accumulates distinct molecular changes. Now, I don't know if you remember headlines like 1% difference between man and chimpanzee and all of that stuff. The very first paper, which was by Vince Sarich and Alan Wilson, was rubbished by the paleontologists who said, no, they've made a mistake. We all know that humans separated from the great apes 15 million years ago. Wilson and Sarich said that they separated, I think it was 4.5 or 5 million years ago, and that can't be true. And I looked into it, and in looking into it, I came to the conclusion that actually it was much more likely to be true than the fossil record was telling us. And so I must have spent two or three afternoons talking to John about it and saying, no, this is for real. Human evolution separate from the great apes is much less old than we thought it was. And he already was a well-published author by that time, and he said, we should write this up. And I said, okay. And so we did, on an Apple IIe, if you believe that. We wrote alternate chapters. We edited alternate chapters. I challenge anyone to tell you which bits I wrote and which bits he wrote. And that was the start of a book called The Monkey Puzzle. And that the second part of that, if you like, was The Redundant Male, which is kind of following on from some work actually before The Selfish Gene, but some work about human evolution and particularly the evolution of sex as a reproductive strategy. That's how those both of those we each had agents, literary agents, and in those days you prepared a proposal, the agent gave you some feedback on the proposal, and then the agent hawked it around to different publishers, and if a publisher wanted it, they bid for it, and you got an advance, and you went off and wrote the book. And that's how it worked.
Any plans on writing any more books in the future? Either perhaps maybe not on evolution of humans or living things, but perhaps food or other topics that you enjoy?
I'd love to. There's a real problem, though. And that problem actually hasn't gone away since 1984. And that is, how do you make a living while writing a book? And there are a couple of answers to that. One is that you have another job. And when I was writing Man-Made Life, The Redundant Male. Man-Made Life was actually my first book. But when I was writing Man-Made Life and The Monkey Puzzle, I had a day job. I had two day jobs, in fact. I had a day job as a lecturer in a university, and I also had a day job working for New Scientist magazine. And so that provides two things. It provides an income, and it also provides access. So you can, if you're doing a story involving scientific research, you can find a small bit of it and write a feature article about it, which then goes into the book, or rather the research for which goes into the book. So that's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is to get a huge advance from a publisher, large enough to live on, so that you can devote yourself full time to writing the book. I've never had that. I've never had that. And
I think that would be very rare.
It's very rare for nonfiction, but that it's like these silly unicorns. I mean, I know people who've had advances of $100,000 for a book. Not lately, I confess. I know people who've done that, and it's brilliant. But the publisher's interests and your interests are somewhat divergent, because the publisher will pay you a giant advance because they think they can sell a lot of copies. And once they've sold enough copies to get the advance back, then they're not really that interested in continuing to sell it. So the way you get a giant advance is by having a very pushy agent, but also having a sensational story to tell. And both The Redundant Male and Monkey Puzzle had interesting stories to tell, but I wouldn't say they were completely sensational. They could have been sold up, hyped up, but I'm not comfortable with that. So, getting a giant advance is out of the question, and it's even more out of the question today. And then the other way is you do it in your spare time and then try and sell a finished manuscript. But that's really, really hard. Most mainstream publishers will barely look at a finished manuscript. Most agents will look at it, but if you're not already with an agent, it's really hard to find one. And if you haven't got an agent, it's very hard to find a publisher. But, and the really good news is, you can do it yourself. You can publish yourself. And whereas it used to be the case that, you know, we laughed at vanity presses where essentially you paid for the privilege of getting your book published, these days I think it is possible to publish your own book. It's possible to buy in editing help, which you definitely need to do. No matter how good you are, another pair of eyes is always great. You can buy a cover design so you don't end up being lampooned on those sites that lampoon self-published covers. You can do it yourself, and you can distribute hard copies or you can distribute ebooks. I mean, you know this. You know this far better than I do. And I'm very tempted to do that. My real problem is finding the time to do it reasonably quickly so that I'm not just squeezing it in between everything else. And that means finding the resources to do it. And I haven't figured out a way to do that. There's a Kickstarter just for books. I mean, a crowdfunding thing just for books, and which I found out about because I wanted a copy of a book that somebody was proposing to write. And I've thought of doing that. I did a podcast series in the summer for the Dog Days of Podcasting, in which I looked at the emblematic industrial food, which is the chicken, and how it came to be that way. And I really would quite like to write that book. I've got an outline. The sorts of things I need to say. I haven't tried selling it to a proper publisher yet. I haven't done the work of turning it into a proper proposal. And I'm not sure whether to do that or try and crowdfund it.
Well, if you do go and publish that through traditional sources or self-publish, I'd be very interested in reading that book. And I think a lot of people would also want to read more about that. During your Dog Days episodes, I think those episodes that you made received the most attention from the other participants of the challenge. And that's great. I think that a lot of people are very interested in where their food comes from, particularly now when there's so much awareness is the wrong word, but when there's so much focus on what we should eat and how we should eat. I think people would be very interested to learn more about the chicken and how it's evolved, or I should say how we forced it to evolve over the last century.
Yeah, Well, thank you. I mean, I agree. That's why I did the series, and that's why I really do want to write the book. I'm very torn at the moment, though. I'll be perfectly honest. I've got so many things I have to do and so many things I want to do. And, well, the have to do. I mean, I need to make a living. You'd have thought that by this stage in my life, I'd have saved up enough money so that I could live on it. But I haven't and I can't. So I need to keep earning. And it's difficult to find the time to do concerted bits of work. I mean, it takes time to do research. The internet is a fire hose. Doing research on the internet gives you 99 pieces of rubbish for every nugget of gold. I need to find the time to go to a library and sit in a library and read actual bits of paper and talk to real human beings. And it's very hard to find backing for that kind of academic-ish research. I've thought about going back into teaching simply in order to enable myself to do that, but there are no openings in that realm either. So I will somehow find a way to do it. I'm just not sure how.
Well, I guess this is a good time to ask about the current job, because you have transitioned from working for a virtual company in the UK to working for yourself. And I understand that working for yourself usually means you have a lot more things to worry about, taxation, accounts receivable, accounts payable, like all of these very important but very time-consuming activities. But that being said, by being your own boss, do you think you will have the flexibility to carve out a week a month or 2 weeks a season to just dedicate to your own personal projects rather than client projects?
That's absolutely the point, and you're absolutely right. After all this time, I still regard it as unproductive to be writing invoices. And of course, that's stupid. How are you going to get paid unless you write an invoice? But nevertheless, my brain won't let me think of it that way. The whole point is that my costs for doing a specific job are lower than any company would charge for me to do it. And so if I can have a few clients to work with, it's win-win. They pay less for my services and I get more for the time I spend with them. And so the idea was to try and maintain my income level but spend less time doing it, which is so far is happening. The problem, and I don't want to be ungrateful, the problem is the clients. I'll be perfectly honest with you. Today, I was looking forward to talking to you as a little break in what ought to have been a really hard day. I'm doing a document for somebody, and they were supposed to get the final draft for my final edit to me this morning. And it wasn't here this morning, and so the rest of my week now has to be juggled in order to accommodate the client. And that's the hardest part about it. You can't actually say, well, you know, you should have thought about this before you didn't get your work back to me, because they won't hire you again. In this case, that might not be such a bad thing. You know, you have to keep some clients happy, but you don't have to take all clients. Yes, it ought to give me more time, but if you know my schedule, you know that it's now, today is the day when normally I would have released a podcast episode. I haven't. I'm hoping to get one done for tomorrow. One of the nice things about podcasting is, of course, that you don't absolutely have to do things on schedule. But the reason I haven't done it is because I was working for this particular client all last week trying to meet their deadlines. And I did meet their deadlines. And now the one deadline I needed them to meet, they haven't met. So, you know, that's how it goes. But it does mean that carving out these days for myself is actually rather difficult.
Would you consider going back to your previous job if you were able to work on reduced load, like for example, 3 days a week or 4 days a week. This way you could still have time for your things as well as a steady income, and you wouldn't have to deal with these kinds of hassles as much.
If they paid me 100% for 80% or 60%, yeah, sure. But they're not going to do that. I mean, the thing is, with freelancing, I can make 100% in 60% of the time, but I can't guarantee when the 60% of the time will be needed. I mean, I had a wonderful day on Friday. I took Friday off because I'd met my deadlines and that nothing was expected until Monday. And so I had a wonderful day. Completely taking care of myself. But I didn't do my work because I didn't think I'd have to. In fact, I thought I'd have Tuesday, tomorrow, as we're recording today, I thought I'd have more time this week to do it, but it's not going to work out. I'm not nearly as focused as perhaps I should be, so that when I block time out, it can't be absolute. If a client is late, then my projects have to take second place.
What is your main concern going forward? Is it this variability from clients?
I think I do have clients who need my services consistently, and they're wonderful, and I just hope that their budgets hold up and that they continue to use me and that I continue to be useful to them. That's the backbone of the work. Getting rid of some clients, way back when I started in this business, I recognized that if you don't want to do a job, then quoting what you consider to be an outrageous amount of money doesn't make you want to do the job. Money's not the point. So I have learned that if I don't want to do a job, then I better just say, I don't want to do this job. I'm sorry I'm busy, or I'm sorry. I'm sorry I'm busy is the best one. Please try me again later, and hope that they do. Because getting 10,000 instead of 1,000 for a job doesn't make the job actually any easier. My main concern is how to get an income to do the things I actually really love doing, and that's podcasting and writing about science. And we've talked about this. I don't feel that I have anything extra to offer people who want to support me, nor do I have anything popular enough that I can only offer it to people to support me. I'm not going to make my podcast pay only. There's no point getting my podcast a day, a week, a month early. It's not timeful information. I mean, it doesn't matter when it happens, really. There are bits I could possibly do, and I've been thinking about them. But basically, I would like to be able to be paid by some people to do what I do. And one of my thoughts at the moment, I do lectures, I do seminars, and it would be nice to have some invitations come in to go and do a seminar somewhere and to be paid to do it. It would be nice for people who are running conferences to recognize that it might be worth paying somebody to do a podcast from that conference, not in my series, in their own. I've been doing a bit of that. I mean, I have one client for whom I do a monthly podcast, and that's been going really well. But their budget is also not exactly fixed for 2016, and so I don't know if that continues. That would be great. But it's finding a way to make enough money to enable me to do the things I want to do, and a lot of the cost of that is travel. I'm going next week. I'm going to Ireland for a week. Now, I'm going to attend an audio festival, but, and I'm paying for that myself, but while I'm there, I'm going to try and record a couple of shows. The total cost of going is probably somewhere of the order of 500, 600 euros. I don't know how to get 500, 600 euros to get to go to another meeting. You know, so I'll find the money by charging other clients other things. But there's another conference that I will probably go to in January that I went to this year. I would like to go next year because it's a great place to get stories. I'll go. And it's cross-subsidizing, if you like. But I have to do the client work in order to do what I want to do. I mean, the whole business of measuring success, which you were talking to Randolph about too, I don't know how to do that. I've tried to, I've stopped obsessing about downloads and listeners, partly because I can't get the numbers. I don't, you know, short of paying to be hosted somewhere else, which will give you better stats, I don't know how many people listen. I know how many people subscribe to the newsletter, but I have no idea how many subscribers I have in iTunes. Do you? I mean, do you know for your show? I don't know how, you know, the stats. I think there are two really broken things, or not broken, but they've never existed for podcasting. One is stats and the other one is discovery. I don't know how that's going to change. Stats, I certainly have no idea what to do about that. Discovery, yeah, I can see ways in which discovery could become better. But it's not like sending somebody a link. You can't just send somebody a link to a podcast and have them listen to it. There's got to be a better way of sharing what you like about a podcast, and I just haven't found it yet.
Well, some of the ideas that you've talked about in the past with me and other people sound like really good ideas. They're just really hard to implement well, and that's the trick.
I think that's right. I also think that if I won the lottery tomorrow, which is very unlikely because I don't buy tickets, if I won the lottery tomorrow, that's what I would try and spend half a day every day on. I think it would be, and I even have the domain name, but that would be what I would do. I don't know if you saw, but there's this thing that NPR, National, well, they're not National Public Radio anymore because they're NPR, but that they started last week, which is sort of, you know, a podcast, supposedly a podcast discovery thing. But it's just a list of, it's text and links. And I think you can do better than that. I think you can do an audio discovery podcast. And Gimlet Media are supposed to be doing something coming up that's supposed to do with podcast discovery. Maybe that's what they'll be doing. I don't know. I think it's doable. It's just not doable by me at the moment. It would be doable by me if I could somehow find a way to pay myself to do it. And I don't have the resources to say I'm going to make it and people will come, because I can't guarantee that they will.
Well, keeping on topic with your winning the lottery, if you do win the lottery, and I know you put a lot of effort into your podcasts and into a lot of the creations that you build, what is one episode of Eat This Podcast that you would love to put together? What would be your perfect episode?
Oh, Jason, come on. That's an impossible question. Absolutely an impossible question. Okay. Okay. Right now, I am researching a story, which I cannot actually do for audio. It's an embargoed paper that's in the journal Nature coming out on Wednesday of this week. Essentially, a group in Bristol, at Bristol University in England, have pushed back the date for humans being associated with bees by 2,000 years, and they have mapped beekeeping across Europe and how it's spread and where bees are used. And that's very high-tech archaeology, which I love. I mean, I love the science of archaeology. So they do mass spectroscopy on teeny bits of stuff that they find inside pottery. And it's a great unit. So I would love to fly to Bristol and interview them for audio, not just about beeswax, but about the cheese they've found, the beer they've found, the wine they've found on ancient bits of pottery. I would then like to take some of that information and go and talk to a chap in Cincinnati who is an expert on the historical approaches to beekeeping and the design of beehives around the world and how different people have different beehives, but they're all trying to do the same thing. I would like to talk to people about the ways in which wax was used in antiquity. I would like to talk to some people in Jerusalem about the first industrial set of beehives that they discovered. And I would like to put together a program centered on bees, but talking about the science of how you analyze pottery from 9,000 years ago, the history of how you look at historical documents to put together what people were doing back then, and all of that. That's just because that's what I'm working on today. Call me next week and it might well be something else. I don't know if you heard, I did a podcast recently about mayonnaise, or rather about a company that's using plant proteins to make a pseudo-mayonnaise. There's a lot more there that I could do by talking to more individuals and building a story rather than doing an interview. I mean, I was very happy with the interview, but I think there's much more that could be done with building a story. So it's that sort of thing. It's being able to talk to, having the time to be able to talk to lots more people about every story I do. And what I'd ideally, I mean, at the moment I do, what do? On this podcast, I do them every 2 weeks. So I do two stories a month. Ideally, I would like to do 4 stories a month, 3 of which would be small stories, if you like, and 1 of which would be constructed. That would be my ideal schedule. And I could never do that on my own. But I have, you know, there are people I would love to work with who would be available. So there you have it. That's the dream ticket.
Yeah, what you're talking about would require one heck of a staff.
No. It would require 2 to 3 people.
For me, that's one heck of a staff.
Okay, yes. I mean, it's 300% more than I currently have, yeah.
Well, that would be quite interesting. Would you consider using video? Because if you're going to be going around the world, I can see this being something that I think people would also want to see as well as hear. Perhaps you could work with that kind of video storytelling as well.
No. Either you do one or you do the other. I've tried. I mean, it's bad enough trying to take a good still photograph when you're doing an audio interview. It's video. There is so much bad video out at the moment. I mean, you and I have a standing joke about bad audio quality. Bad video is even worse, and bad video with bad audio. No. TV video is a separate kind of job. I like making video, and I've made video. But it takes far more people, it takes far longer, and if you do it in a hurry, it's a mess. So no, I wouldn't want to do that. And I love audio. I just love audio.
Well, I can respect that, and I would love to hear any kind of show that you would put out, because I do really enjoy listening to this podcast. Whenever I see it pop up in my podcatcher, it's always one of the first things I play that day.
Well, thank you very much. And I mean, I hope to keep doing it forever and ever.
I guess this brings us to the next set of questions. Where can people find your work?
That's that's a whole nother discussion, because I keep dithering about that. But the podcast is eatthispodcast.com. Most of my other stuff is jeremychurfus.net. You can find me on ADN @jchurfus, or is it Jeremy Churfus? I can't even remember. Golly. Anyway, Jeremy, search for me, Jeremy Churfus, and you'll find me on app.net. Twitter, Eat Podcast. There's another person at Twitter, but that's not relevant strictly now. Facebook, yeah, I'm there, but I don't much use it. This is my main problem. I cannot bring myself to spend the time using social media to promote what I do. And I know that's silly, and I know I need to do it, but it's just so time consuming.
But there's only so much time in the day.
Exactly, exactly. I just, you know, I try and then I forget, and yeah.
Well, how do you feel about those audio inserting ads, the ones that will follow around the web and find out what they like and then show them contextual ads?
I hate them.
So it's not something you would consider buying.
I mean, there's a just, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. The only thing I might, I did play with Google Ads once. The trouble is that I don't actually know what search terms I would buy. I mean, can you imagine competing for a chicken search term? It's not going to work. I couldn't possibly afford a chicken search term.
I think you would lose to KFC and Chick-fil-A, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, people, I still have the biggest trouble telling people what Eat This Podcast is about, because it's not about recipes, except when it is. It's not about restaurants, except when it is. It's using food to explore all sorts of different things, from prehistoric diet to mayonnaise made without eggs. It's everything, because food is everything. And so I can't even describe that, you know, Lord. If I got in an elevator with Bill Gates or someone, I can't even do the pitch except to say it uses food, which everybody's interested in to some extent, to talk about life. And you know, there you have it.
And there's the pitch.
Yeah, send me my money now.
Well, let me ask one last question. How can people support you if they wanted to? What kind of things would you be receptive to from anybody on the internet if you were to crowdsource or something of that sort?
Okay. That's almost easier than anything else. The most important thing to podcasters is word of mouth and recommendations. If you like a podcast, not just mine, any podcast, tell people about it. Tell your friends to give it a try, because that's how podcasts spread if they don't have giant mega corporations or mini corporations behind them doing a lot of cross promotion. So that's definitely one thing. And linked to that is reviews on iTunes, because good reviews can move you in the mysterious search engine that is iTunes. So that's important. Feedback is incredibly important. It validates everything. To get an email saying, I really enjoyed the podcast. It doesn't have to say any more than that. So feedback is good. Ideas and suggestions is good. I do get some programs come about as a result of somebody saying, hey, I've done X, or my friend has done X. Is that interesting to you? And very often it is. So that's another thing. And then if anybody has any ideas as to how to get real financial support, I'd be happy to listen to that too. So yeah, there's a contact me button on eatthispodcast.com, but just anything, any email to @eatthispodcast.com will find me.
All right. Well, that's good to know. And for our listeners, of course, all of these links, or the vast majority of them, will be in the show notes. And you should find those in any podcatcher, or, of course, head over to the website and the links will be there as well. And I believe this brings us to the end of this second episode of the second season. So I'd like to thank you once again, Jeremy, for being my guest today.
Thank you, Jason. It's been a pleasure again.